Everyone get a seat. Well, good evening, everyone. It's really nice to see so many of you have braved the elements to come to the first Wesoa meeting of the year. We're going to hear about saving lives, improving mothers' care. This document here, which was published by Embrace just at the end of last year, so it's pretty topical. I had to actually look up what Embrace stands for. It's Mothers and Babies Reducing Risk Through Audits and Confidential Inquiries Across the UK. Fairly rolls off the tongue. I think everybody here probably will already know our speaker. Dr. Liz McGrady is one of the consultant anaesthetists at the Princess Royal Maternity Unit, and she was one of the assessors of saving mothers' lives, improving mothers' care, so she's very well placed to tell us all about it. So thank you very much, Liz.
Thank you, Alison. Just shout out if I'm speaking too fast or you can't hear what I'm saying.
Do you want the lights
on? Yes, I don't know how to do that. There's lots of funny switches here, but none of them seem to work. Thank you. Right. So Embrace. So the terminology has changed over the years. The report's now called, instead of report on maternal death, it's saving mothers' lives, improving mothers' care seems a more sensible topic title and slightly more optimistic sounding. This is the new look report, and I'll show you pictures of the old reports that some of you will recognise. It's been produced by the National Perinatal and Epidemiology Unit in Oxford, and I got involved in it because I was the anaesthetic assessor for Scotland in the previous report, and some of us were asked to put our names forward to be assessors for the new system. These are the old reports. The one on your left-hand side, one of the older ones, it was Why Mothers Die, and over the years the name evolved into Saving Mothers' Lives in a slightly more upmarket or upbeat tone. So basically, it's a continuation of the old maternal death inquiry that started in 1952 and was done in different nations at the time, and now it's all done as the one nation. It used to be called, or the most recent name before this one was CMACE, the Centre for Maternal and Child Inquiries, ran the report. And then about 2009, some European legislation, I think, mandated that it had to be put out to tender. And it was perceived to be too expensive. And I think in the background there's also some thoughts about why are we doing this? Why are we doing this report every 3 years? What does it do? Does it change anything? Are we just changing the order of the death rates, as it were? Is it actually achieving anything? I actually firmly believe it does achieve something, but these questions were being asked. Unfortunately, they were answered, and they decided to proceed with the report, and the contract was awarded to the NPEU in Oxford. And it's restarted in 2012. Of course, by that time, there was a lot of backlog of cases. The Scottish cases had still been assessed. I'd still been involved in that. But the rest of the new cases hadn't been assessed. So there was a huge number of cases that had to be reviewed and a number of reviewers recruited. Okay, so the format of the report has changed in that one of the criticisms was it was every 3 years, and given the amount of time taken to get all those cases together and have them assessed, it was really quite out. You could say it was out of date by the time it came out. So like the 2006 to 2008 report was reviewing cases as far back as 2006, but the report didn't come out till 2011. So there's now going to be an annual report which will be surveying the death rates and trying to pick up trends earlier. But there'll only be specific topics addressed in every report. So for example, in the report I'm going to talk about today, there's a surveillance report on all the deaths from 2009-2012. That's a four-year period. The topics it will focus on will be the mothers who died from sepsis, deaths from haemorrhage, amniotic fluid embolism, anaesthesia, neurological, respiratory, endocrine and other indirect causes. The report that will come out next year, and they're already getting together to have chapter writing groups in that, will again give you the surveillance data on the death rates, but will focus on psychiatric deaths, deaths due to thrombosis, thromboembolism, malignancy and so on. And then on to 2016, you can see there the topics they will cover. So they're trying to make it more up to date and more relevant to the people reviewing it. So the topics in this report are sepsis, haemorrhage, amniotic fluid embolism, anaesthesia, neurological, other indirect causes, other medical and surgical deaths, and also a review of mothers who survived sepsis. And that's been achieved. There's been a focus now on morbidity, severe maternal morbidity. We had a very good report in Scotland, which has been stopped, unfortunately. This isn't adopting the same methodology, but there's the UK obstetric surveillance system that many of you will be aware of. They did do a review of mothers who survived sepsis, and that's been incorporated in this report, comparing standards of care in the mothers who survived sepsis and those who succumbed. So this is the front cover of the report. The author, there's a pointer there, Marion Knight, she's the kind of lead that I know, who's based in Oxford, as is Jenny Gula, I can never pronounce that name. But anyway, they're all kind of based in Oxford, and some of us go down there to help write some of the chapters. And it's a much less expensive operation, I understand, and they have quite a tight budget. So what's the key messages? Well, there's been a significant reduction in maternal death rates from 11 in the 2006-2008 report to 10 in the 2010-2012 numbers. So remember, your maternal death rate is the number of maternal deaths per 100,000 women giving birth. So it's gone from 11 to 10, and it stayed kind of static, almost plateaued for a number of reports. Indeed, it slightly increased for a while, which was probably due to maybe better identification of deaths. But the fact there's been a significant reduction, I think, is a sign of improved care, because not just has it been reduced in isolation, but it's been reduced in the face of the changing demographics we're all aware of: rising maternal age, rising obesity rates, rising section rates. Right, this is for trainees who are here. It's a bit boring, but definitions are important. You get asked about in exams. I don't know how many trainees actually pre-exam are here. But just to remind you, a maternal death is a death while pregnant or within 42 days. So that's 6 weeks of delivery. And that's the international definition. A direct death is from obstetric complications of the pregnant state, whereas indirect deaths are deaths resulting from previous disease which have been worsened by the physiological changes of pregnancy. And late deaths, which are not included in the maternal mortality rate but are included in the report, are from 6 weeks, that's 42 days, up to a year. So 2/3 of the deaths are indirect deaths. That's mothers dying from heart disease, epilepsy, suicide, blah, 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 blah. Flu was a big one in the most recent report. And only 1/3 are direct deaths. It used to be the other way around. There used to be more direct deaths than indirect deaths. And there's a feeling throughout the report that we're not really addressing the indirect causes of death as well as the direct causes. We've got very good guidelines in management preeclampsia, venous thromboembolism, hemorrhage, sepsis now as well. We're getting better at identifying people. But this rather diffuse group is maybe much harder. So the focus in the report is trying to maybe focus on those mothers and try and improve care for them. And what's clear is that sometimes could be improved. So 2/3 of mothers die from indirect causes, and only 1/3 from direct complications of pregnancy, such as bleeding or preeclampsia. And 3/4 of the mothers who died had medical or mental health problems before they became pregnant, so they were already at risk. And there's a great emphasis on these mothers who are known to have problems before they're pregnant. They get pre-pregnancy counselling, and they get joint specialists in maternity care, that they're not done in isolation. That if you've got epilepsy, you see a neurologist who knows about the implications of epilepsy in pregnancy, hopefully in a sort of clinic that's with a joined up with an antenatal clinic. You can get obstetric or maternity sort of specialists, mental health nurses who specialise in maternity care, and I only recently found out that we've got one in our hospital. So, you know, sometimes things are going on that you're not aware of already. Almost 1/4 of the women who died had sepsis, and there's this recurrent emphasis on mothers with sepsis needing early diagnosis, rapid antibiotics, and review by senior doctors and midwives. I know that's preaching to the converted here, we all know that, but there are some cases still that slip through the net. And prevent flu. 1 in 11 of the women who died overall died from flu. Of course, this period was during the H1N1 pandemic. I think about 36 women died from H1N1. My understanding is that you're not more likely to get flu if you're pregnant, but if you get it, you're something like 7 times more likely to need intensive care, and you're 7 times more likely to die. So it's really important that they're vaccinated. I think all this publicity about the most recent vaccine not covering this year's flu bug is difficult, because I suspect that will encourage people not to take part in the vaccination process. But I think if you're pregnant, it's really, really, really important, because some of the reading the deaths of these women is just harrowing. The rapidity with how unwell they got, how sick they got, and that was pretty gruesome if you're pregnant. So just a reminder, this is the overall reduction over the years from 2004, and if we went up to when the maternal death report started, this would be way up here. But from 2004, a nice gradual decline with the odd blip in the maternal death rate, but that's primarily through a fall in indirect maternal deaths, whereas this little dotted line here is the direct maternal deaths, and they're going up a wee bit, which is a bit concerning. Did somebody say something there? Did I say it the other way? Sorry. You know what I mean. So direct's going down, indirect's going up. That's what I meant to say, sorry. And these are the dark purple colour are the indirect deaths. So this is the sort of the league table, as it were, of what causes death. And other indirect causes is always a big group that incorporates a huge number of things. But things like H1N1 are in there. Flu, so things like flu deaths aren't included in sepsis. Sepsis is just the genital tract sepsis, but... So this part here is indirect deaths, and that's primarily flus, asthmas, tumours, you know, lots of different things. Cardiac diseases on their own are always a huge chunk of the causes of death. Neurological, a number of epilepsy deaths that we'll talk about later. And then the head at this time of the direct deaths is thrombosis. Genital tract sepsis has come down a bit. It was the leading cause in the last report of direct deaths, and here we are way down here. Anaesthesia is way down here, which is great, because of course when I started back in the day, it was way up here. So it's one of the commoner causes of, it's the third commonest cause of direct maternal death. So that's good news for us. So there's a whole bunch of key messages for different people in it, for managers, for obstetricians, for blah blah blah. So I've just picked out one or two that I think might be of particular interest in the report. This whole emphasis on women with medical disorders and pregnancy having access to coordinated multidisciplinary obstetric and medical clinics. That is coming. I'm sure you're all aware of this happening, but there'll be more emphasis on that. Senior people being involved in a care who are good at communication, who pick up the phone and phone each other, don't do it via trainees. This is of interest to us. There should be adequate provision of appropriate critical care support for the management of pregnant women becomes unwell. And Kerry and very, to a small extent, I are involved in the maternal critical care group that the OAA is organising. It's a multidisciplinary group including midwives, obstetricians, intensivists, trying to get some common terminology for maternal critical care and trying to come forward with recommendations for how that should be managed and who should do it, who should provide it, how they should be educated. It's clear one size won't necessarily fit all, but that's something that has to be addressed, because I'm sure most of our units are the same. The women are looked after by midwives who haven't had the advantage of education in high dependency care. Some have, but it's not 24 hours a day cover. This sounds unbelievably simple. All women with any symptoms or signs of ill health, including those who are postnatal, should have a full set of basic observations taken. Temperature, pulse rate, respiratory and blood pressure. You think, why do you have to put that in? Well, you do have to put it in, because that doesn't always happen. And there is concern that this emphasis on normality in pregnancy has, the pendulum's gone too far, and it's almost like people are offended if you ask them to check somebody's blood pressure. If you don't have those basic things stuck in a chart, you don't know where you're starting from and you don't see the trends where things change. Again, I know I'm preaching to the converted, but that message is in there because it doesn't always happen. And it's heartbreaking when you realise that sometimes these tasks are allocated to very junior people. We've seen it in our own units. They're not necessarily midwives. They're they called care assistants or something. Some of them who are very, very good, some aren't. But they may be people who are distracted, don't realise that they don't actually realise how big... how important those little individual tasks are, and they don't do them, and then things aren't picked up. And you do see it when you read the death reports. And other stuff about junior staff, and this has come in every single report, junior staff shouldn't hesitate to seek senior advice. Consultant referral is appropriate when specialist advice is needed. And this part about all staff participating in the inquiry, some people refuse to fill in assessment forms. And also if there is a, whatever you term that, call it untoward incident inquiries or critical event inquiries, every hospital should have a system for looking at critical events and the right people being at them. It's quite often you'd actually see that the hospital sat down and tried to review a maternal death, but they hadn't invited key people, like anaesthetists were often excluded, and yet they'd looked after most of the care. And most people actually really tried hard to try and unravel it all, but there are some groups that seem to just pat each other on the back and say they'd all done a good job and wasn't it a shame. But in fact, you should have probably somebody external coming in some of these reviews to ensure that you're taking a balanced view of it. Anyway, so 357 women died while pregnant or up to 6 weeks after the end of their pregnancy. And the maternal mortality rate is 10.12 per 100,000 maternities. As I said already, a fall in direct deaths, but particularly medical and psychiatric causes still an issue. So there were, as I said earlier, some of these, there were specific topics addressed. Sepsis was the first one. So I was going to go through that, and the messages that come up through the report are here. And we were very familiar with this, about sepsis 6 and all that, but thinking about sepsis at an early stage, trying to get that message out to everyone who sees obstetric patients, so it's not just us that know about it, that everyone knows about it. Because for all we think the care in our units is probably great, we're probably also all aware every now and then somebody's slipping through the net and not being picked up in time. And that's usually because they've seen the wrong person in the wrong place, or somebody quite junior who doesn't pick up on things. So it's this, you know, ensuring people are seen early, you know, untoward signs are picked up on and acted on and escalated in an appropriate way is hugely important. There's emphasis on the fact that repeated presentation to a GP or a maternity unit or whoever is important as a red flag sign. If somebody keeps on going to the effort of going back to somebody and saying, I'm not right, I'm not right, I'm not right, they should just be brought in and investigated, because there's a real chance there could be something going on that people just haven't picked up. Early advice from microbiologists and appropriate physicians, and this further emphasis on influenza vaccination. So genital tract sepsis, that's the thing that everyone was worried about in the last report, because it had done this big rise here from 2003 up to 2008. There's a big increase in genital tract sepsis, and I think we are all very conscious of it, and it has shown a gratifying fall in this most recent report. I think we are very aware of it. And I'm sure part of that is due to enhanced care, better care, more awareness about it. Part of it could also be that I think the streptococcus involved seems to vary in pathogenicity as well. They have different phage types that are more toxic than others, and that could be related to that as well. Because I think over the decades, over the centuries, puerperal sepsis has varied in its severity and its pathogenicity. So hopefully that'll keep on coming down. I think part of that is everyone doing a better job. Part of it might be just the bug varying a wee bit. They still do these little vignettes of deaths, and I think that's when people really sit up and take notice. Because they're describing cases that we could all see any day of the week. Usually very sad, unfortunately, but this was a lady who had a sore throat but can be a red flag in pregnancy, with lymphadenopathy, diarrhea and vomiting. That's diarrhea, vomiting, abdominal pain, often a symptom of sepsis or a sign of sepsis. She was hypertensive and tachycardic, but seen by a junior doctor 3 hours after admission, didn't really work out, didn't grasp how serious it was. She was seen at 6 hours by a registrar who prescribed antibiotics, didn't make sure they were given. That's a real thing. You know, you don't write things down and assume somebody's going to do it. Make sure it's done. But she, despite her, belatedly then realising how ill she was, she succumbed to group A strep. And there's a number of vignettes like that. Here's another lady, 2 hours after delivery, a lady became unwell and faint on the postnatal ward. Saturation was 65%. You think that would get something happening, but she was seen by somebody quite junior, found to be shocked with moderate PV bleeding, and then they got this fixation error thing where they decided she died of hemorrhage. She had hemorrhage and that's why she was struggling. So they gave her lots and lots of fluids, and they spent a very long time in theatre doing hysterectomies and all sorts of things. But belatedly, they realised she's a group A strep sepsis. I think she got antibiotics very belatedly through that whole process. It may have been too late anyway, but had she got it here or whenever she started to get unwell, because if you don't have a Muse chart, you don't know when people start to get unwell, she may have had a chance of survival. The vignettes in pink are the ones where the ladies survived. These are the ones from the UKOS surviving sepsis study. And this was a lady, but also it highlights that not everything's done right either. She's a temperature 5 days post-SVD, a temperature 41. Queen to midwife saw, but didn't do any other observations. And that's not uncommon, that they haven't done the full set of basic observations. She discussed it with the GP, who thought it was a virus. So anyway, it's easy to criticise. You don't know what else was going on. She was seen later, and because she was in aporexal, having taken some paracetamol, she was still tachycardic and had low blood pressure, but they were falsely reassured. And she got worse, basically, to cut a long story short. Although the midwife asked for a home visit from the GP, she was asked to come to the surgery, where they finally realised that she was pretty unwell and she was admitted and she survives. Then she was given appropriate antibiotics. They realised they had to get rid of the source of the sepsis, which they did. Her uterus was evacuated and she got better. So sometimes the care can be pretty crap, but they're lucky and they get better. Sometimes the care can be excellent and they don't survive. So just kind of increase the odds by providing good care. This was a case of not all sepsises are genital tract sepsis. Pregnancy does something to your immune system that makes you more susceptible to infection. This was a lady with a 3-month history of left frontal headache. And she went back to her GP multiple times, wasn't given any antibiotics. People with this fear of giving medication in pregnancy. I think mothers-to-be are reluctant to take medication, but I think other doctors are reluctant to prescribe it. 4 weeks later, she saw somebody in the antenatal unit who didn't refer her for further investigations, despite localising features, prolonged history of pain, and then eventually presented 3 days before her death from a CNS infection, and it was a very belated diagnosis. Anyway, so they tried to compare. I mean, there weren't direct comparisons. They're trying to compare the mothers who died from sepsis, and these were the mothers who survived. There was 34 in this UKOS survey. And it's just making the point that the mothers who survived, this group on their right, there were still some who had, 21% of that group, they thought their care could have been improved quite dramatically. There could have been significant improvements in care, but they still survived. But a higher proportion had poor care who died. So, by saying that if you have good care, you can still die, doesn't mean we don't give good care. You increase the chances of people surviving. H1N1 was really quite dramatic impact on women, and they seemed to, some of them got ill very, very quickly, so people did pick up their ill. There's a number of reports of people being bundled into ambulances by GPs and rushed to A&E, and people doing CPR in A&Es, and people doing perimortem sections, etc., all to no avail. So it's a pretty nasty bug. I don't think any of those women who died had been vaccinated, although, to be fair, the vaccination programme had only started kind of halfway through. There were people who refused the vaccination. There were people who refused neuraminidase inhibitor treatment in that group. But I don't think any people who had the vaccination died of flu. So it does seem particularly toxic to mothers-to-be. And it remains the RCOG guideline that you do give neuraminidase inhibitor treatment if you're considering that the mother might flu before you have a diagnosis. So if somebody comes in with a respiratory infection, you don't have a diagnosis, you should probably give whatever your unit's using as an antiviral medication. And that's still the recommended guidance. There's a lot of publicity that this stuff doesn't work that well, but I think pregnancy is a different kettle of fish, and if that's RCOG guidance and the H1N1 is so toxic to mothers, then I think we have to stick to that until there's better evidence that it doesn't work. And, of course, further emphasis on the flu vaccination. Number of mothers die from haemorrhage, and, again, these are some of the key messages they have. there's an increasing emphasis in trying to get good hemoglobins in mothers before they come for delivery. I mean, I think we see that ourselves in our own practice, really trying to get everyone's hemoglobin up to a better level. I think we see fewer mothers coming to theatre for a dissection with a hemoglobin below 10. I believe it could be done better from what the midwives tell me, not from my personal views. They don't feel it's optimal yet, but they are trying to give more supplements to try and optimise hemoglobins before they come. There's a big emphasis here about fluid resuscitation and blood transfusion not being delayed because of a false reassurance from one hemoglobin result. There were a number of cases where one hemoglobin popped up and it was 9.8 and they didn't get any blood. But of course they were in the middle of a fluid resuscitation, in the middle of maybe an ongoing blood loss situation. And of course the next hemoglobin came back would be 4 or 5. And we've all seen that happen. And just a reminder... I don't think we need reminding, but I think other people do, that a young woman's vital signs will stay stable for a very, very long time before she decompensates. And respiratory rate is an important vital sign to measure. Blah, 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 blah. I'm not going to go through every single bit of it because I'm sure you can all read the report yourself. But it's just, once again, this emphasis on don't delay transfusion because of a single hemoglobin measurement. Here's another sorry tale. This woman had genital tract trauma, sent the bleeding not recognised or not conveyed to the anaesthetist in theatre. One of the things when you're reading these reports is you're very aware there's other stuff going on. Reading this, you think, well, why didn't the anaesthetist go and see her preoperatively? Chances were that anaesthetist was doing something else. And you're very conscious of the fact that labour wards are busy, busy places. And we'll all be aware at times that we probably don't provide the care we'd like to because you're busy with doing something and then you've got to go and something involved in something else. So always be aware there's things happening that you don't necessarily know of. We've all been caught out in this way, but this wasn't picked up and it wasn't conveyed that she'd lost a significant blood loss. Before she went to theatre, she had another significant blood loss. She only had one unit of blood because there'd been this single measurement of haemoglobin which had said it was 11, probably before fluid resuscitation. She bled all that in the room before she got to theatre and she succumbed to hemorrhage. An anemic woman had a section. Again, it's unfortunate you'd go to theatre for a section with an anemia that she did. The fact that she was small stature wasn't really picked up on, so therefore a litre blood loss at surgery wasn't picked up as being significant. We see that quite often. But we see a huge range in the size of our mothers, so the next slide is going to talk about that a little bit. But anyway, she had a further bleed and very belated and then very rushed transfusion of lots and lots of crystalloid and colloid, and basically she got pulmonary edema and was transferred to ITU where she died from multi-organ failure. So just really bad management. I remember that case, that was just very, nobody taking a lead in it, nobody really taking charge. Da-da-da-da-da. Oh, it's just too miserable to read some of them. Anyway, so just to remind you, physiological disturbances, young fit women come quite late, and when they decompensate, you're on the road to disaster often. This little table here talks about blood volumes and pregnancy. This is in the report. I actually tried to print it off the other day, but our printer wasn't working very well. But I'm going to stick this around our own unit and maybe get some laminated copies. It's reminding us to think about the weights of our mothers and their blood volumes before they start. This chart assumes they're blood volume at term is 100 mL per kilo. We do have some mothers who are as small as 50 kilograms. We had just one the other day. So their starting off blood volume is 5 litres. So if they bleed 1,500 mL, they've bled 30% of their blood volume. We do get ladies a lot larger. It's supposed to be lean body mass is how you estimate your blood volume. So the lady who's 140 kilos, maybe you're going to have to assume they don't have a 14-litre blood volume, but a bit of common sense has to be applied. But it's a reminder that we do see a huge variation in dimension in our mums, so we should as well as thinking about what the starting haemoglobin is and measuring blood loss better, which we're already doing, we should be thinking about what was their blood volume when they started. And I think that's something there'll be more emphasis on. Let me just be drinking water there. So, anaortic fluid embolism, that's one of the other key topics of this report. Mortality is reported as 11 to 61%, and there's a strong impression that women should survive amniotic fluid, or should have a reasonable chance of surviving amniotic fluid embolism if it's thought about and treated appropriately. In this current report, 11 mothers died. it's a reminder that basically with an amniotic fluid embolism, there seems to be a catastrophic cardiovascular collapse, and in those circumstances, we are thinking about perimortem cesarean section carried out within 5 minutes. And in that circumstance, also be thinking of why it's happened. If you're thinking amniotic fluid embolism, but you are likely to be in that situation, you have to start thinking about a massive obstetric hemorrhage call out and protocol and starting to get blood products, because that's one thing, if it is an AFE, that likely save the mother is you being supportive while also giving her blood products to treat the massive coagulopathy. And with that quite aggressive approach, clearly some mothers are surviving it. This picture gives you a warning, that's supposed to be fetal squames in there in some poor person's lung. So this is a vignette of our AFE. Induction of labour is often, particularly hyperstimulation is associated with AFE. She had a sudden collapse, but nobody seemed to pick up that she had. I think it was just confusion. Nobody really grasped just how decompensated she was. So CPR wasn't, nobody really worked out, was she really unconscious, was she not, had she rested, had she not. So full CPR didn't really start immediately. And then she eventually went to theatre another 20 minutes later, where she was treated aggressively but rather belatedly, and she had had an AFE. Perhaps prompter treatment might have had a better outcome. I'm not going to go through all this because you can read this in the report yourself, but it's further advice about perimortem section, about the timing of how to do it, not moving the mother to theatre, not waiting for an anaesthetic, just if the mother's collapsed, then you go on with it. I mean, it does seem sensible to make sure they have had a cardiac arrest before you do it. It could be a bit unfortunate, so that make sure the monitor hasn't fallen off or the pulse ox hasn't just fallen off. But in general, it's just common sense, that you do it on the spot. But that's easier to say, harder to do, I think, isn't it? It takes a while to click that that's really what you're going to have to do. And it's easy to say, but I've not actually been involved in that kind of case. Right, so on to anaesthesia. We're getting there. So used to be anaesthetic desk was the head of the anaesthetic chapter. That was the title for it, but that's not what's there now. It says lessons for anaesthesia, not anaesthetic desk, because there's actually been a pleasantly small number of direct deaths related to anaesthesia, 4 in this report only, but we are involved in the care of a huge number of the mothers who die. So what's good about this is that there's not been the usual trickle of airway disasters to relate. That's great, I think. But we are clearly involved in the care of a lot of these critically ill mothers, and we have a great influence on how their care is provided. So there's a whole chapter about lessons for anaesthesia, some of which I'll cover here, but there only were 4 direct maternal deaths. So 2 of the deaths were related to subdural hematomas and cerebral venous thrombosis, and it's just a reminder of us to be conscious of that, of the severe sequelae that sometimes happens after accidental dural puncture. A reminder for us to practice drills for managing perioperative airway crises, severe bronchospasm, etc., etc. We all think we can manage it until we actually face with it on the day. So that's not just trainees, that's consultants too. So practice drills are difficult though, aren't they? I mean, when do you fit that into a busy day? But that's something we should probably pay more attention to. I love this one. Pregnant or postpartum women recovering from anaesthesia require the same standard of postoperative monitoring, including documentation, as non-obstetric patients. I mean, that's something that shouldn't be in there. That should have been sorted out decades ago. But there are some signs that that's finally going to change, and certainly in Greater Glasgow Clyde. And it has changed some places already. So hopefully that's going to be addressed. But why should obstetric patients be recovered by people who have not had any training in recovery? Why is that all right? You'd never do it anywhere else in the hospital. Why is it okay for obstetric patients? You wouldn't look after high dependency, mothers requiring high dependency care anywhere else in the hospital that didn't have specialist nurses. Why is it okay in the maternity unit? I know why it's evolved, but we have to ask these questions. Why is it different for obstetric patients? They deserve at least as good care as non-obstetric patients. And I think that's still taking a longer time to get to that point than with other groups of patients. For all sorts of reasons, of which it's not worth getting into, but we have to, I think, we all have to keep fighting that battle. And you can read all that yourselves. I mean, you can read. I'm sure most of you already probably have read the report. There's also this concern that women have been coming in getting CPR, but they haven't had a wage in place. That's always in the background. So what were the anaesthetic deaths? Well, two women experienced prolonged hyperventilation during or following general anaesthesia for treatment of postpartum hemorrhage. Very unclear what was going on. They were overweight. There was quite significant hyperventilation, which may or may not have been due to bronchospasm, but there was all sorts of concerns that the tube wasn't the right place, and the tube was in, the tube was out, and it was quite a long time before reintubation at one time. So, you know, we have to, you know, that there's only two in that 4-year period. So I'm not saying it's a common problem, but we have to be aware of our airway strategies. I think recent NAP reports have looked into that as well, and we're getting a bit better. Sorry. What did you do there? And I know that the Difficult Airway Society is soon to produce new guidelines for obstetrics. That's intradural taps. One lady clearly had a subdural hematoma, and another lady developed a cerebral vein thrombosis, which wasn't due to her accidental dural puncture, but both of them developed severe headaches after delivery, and they weren't really assessed or treated properly. And one of the emphases on that is that we should be better at sending GPs letters about accidental dural puncture and what might be expected and what can recur, so that they know what to do if the woman comes with a headache, because sometimes they're sent into the wrong place and nobody picks up the significance of it. Whereas if they'd seen an obstetric anaesthetist, they might realise the significance of it. So that's just more of the same old things. Worry, big of an emphasis on fixation error, not assuming it's one thing. Always take a step back, get other people around you. I think that's one thing we're much better at now, is saying to other people, what do you think it is? I've got no shame in asking people, I'm stuck, you know, what do you think? Whereas when I first was appointed consultant, which was quite a long time ago, it had been seen as a sign of weakness, I think, to say, I'm not sure what to do here, what do you think? I always felt I had to have all the answers, whereas now I think we're quite happy to confer with whoever's around, intensivist, anyone, what do you think, and get a second opinion, so you don't get stuck in the wrong thing, that you're not missing something. Further emphasis on our drills, which we probably, you know, we could do better, I'm sure. And this issue about same standard post-operative monitoring and care. One of the more contentious bits, possibly, not to me, but this emphasis on the use of induction agents. There was a feeling that some of the iller mothers got inappropriately high doses of sodium thiopentone. And this came from a number of different assessors reporting on incidents and saying, oh my goodness, these are big doses in sick people. And a concern that perhaps more junior anaesthetists are less familiar with thiopentone than more senior anaesthetists. Is it appropriate to have junior anaesthetists using a drug they're unfamiliar with in the already stressful environment of a labour ward? And a suggestion that anaesthetic departments should consider whether they should consider not using thiopentone any longer as an induction agent. So that's it's not a didactic statement, it's just something to consider. And you know, I personally don't think forcing people to use an agent they're not familiar with in an already difficult environment is particularly helpful. I think senior staff can use what they want as long as it's within the bounds of standard care, but it's what juniors feel comfortable with, and they haven't used it to the same extent as some of the more senior members of the department. And emphasis on other things that we're not very good at sometimes in maternity units, remembering to measure body temperature. Remember that women with abdominal pain severe enough to require parental opioids should be reviewed by senior staff, including anaesthetists. That's significant. Abdominal pain and chest pain severe enough to require opioids or resistant to opioids sometimes is a warning of something sinister going on. Okay, so where are we in? So 4 deaths doesn't sound like very much. Is that, you know, where are we in relation to the rest of of the rate of anaesthetic deaths in the past? Well, this is a very old table. John McClure was involved in presenting this table, and it only goes up to 2000-2002. He was trying to get some measure of how likely you are to die from anaesthesia if you're pregnant. So what he did was, in 64 to 66, apparently there were just over 2.5 million maternities, and the section rate was a blissful 3.4%. Oh my God. So there's lots of extrapolations here. So you extrapolated that to assume what the total number of sections was 88,000, and the number of direct deaths due to anaesthesia in that period was 50. So extrapolate. Basically, the rate of direct deaths due to anaesthesia per 100,000 caesarean sections was estimated to be 36. I have to say that's about the time I was started to give general anaesthetics for caesarean sections. Blissfully unaware of the risks, I must say, at 10 months, I think I was plonked in the rota at Rather Maternity. Don't hesitate to cope. At that time, apparently, the rate was a mere 6 chance of me killing somebody per 100,000 caesarean sections. So even in those far off days, now that was in the days where we did, I knew very little about obstetric anaesthesia. I had a very hazy knowledge of the anatomy of the epidural space and what I was trying to achieve. But I had done an awful lot of intubations by then, even just at 10 months, because we didn't have LMAs. So people say we had much better skills at airway schools, perhaps than training now at 10 months. And that was probably true, but I was remarkably ignorant. I don't think I even knew any night I was on who would be the person to call if there was a problem. I can't remember Joyce. I don't know. I don't think I ever knew who the senior on was, if there was a senior on. They certainly weren't an obstetric anaesthetist. And on one memorable occasion, Tatum McClintock did call for a second consultant to come in, a second person to come in to open the second theatre. And the now deceased person said, "That's absolutely fine. I'll be in the moment, Raymond. Can you just give me directions to Rutherglen Maternity Hospital?" So times have changed. So although we might have done lots of airway things, we didn't know very much. We didn't have guidelines. We didn't have skilled help. I was doing a rapid sequence induction. I remember it well. And the midwife was doing cricoid pressure, went for her tea halfway through the induction. So, and she didn't know. It wasn't her fault. She didn't know anything about her tea. She didn't realise that wasn't good practice. So airway schools might have been better, or just through sheer panic. But there was still a higher rate of death. So John McClure extrapolated figures from 2002. For at that time, a pretty remarkably low section rate of 21%, and thought the rate of direct deaths due to anaesthesia was about 1. So, there's been big improvements, and I think those improvements have continued. We're even better now than before with CAs and so on, targeting people and avoiding giving general anaesthesia to people. We have got challenges, there's no doubt about it, but I don't think there's evidence there that there's been a big upsurge in the number of airway disasters, although I think it's pertinent and right to have concerns about who we're putting on the rota. CT2s are decreasingly experienced, I think, and have done less and less on their own. They might do a lot of supervised cases where they come anywhere near obstetrics, but when we've done our own internal audits, many of them have done very, very little on their own. And my personal view is they need to do more at CT1 on their own if they're going to be expected to do CT2 call in the obstetric unit. But I don't think the obstetric unit is a place to do your first rapid sequence induction. And it's clear that that's actually what happens sometimes. Not always, but sometimes. Anyway, it's nearly time to comb. So there's a whole bunch of neurological deaths. 14 were due to epilepsy, with another 12 late deaths due to epilepsy. So epilepsy is not innocuous in pregnancy. They're supposed to get preconception counselling. There should be a liaison epilepsy nurse, and I've just found out we've got one, I believe, somewhere. They shouldn't be cared for in single rooms. They shouldn't be told not to bathe alone. They should use showers, because some of them just drowned because they had a seizure. They either don't take their medication because they're worried about the baby, or their medication doses change when they're pregnant, particularly lamotrigine. I think it's got variable metabolism in pregnancy, so they are at higher risk. And the SUDET's more common in pregnancy. There's also 26 women died of intracranial hemorrhages. Here's another one. Hopefully this is the last sad story. I'm getting fed up telling sad stories. But this was a lady who was known to be hypertensive, and she was given cinchometrin, unfortunately, just a routine reflex, and she got hypertensive and a massive subarachnoid hemorrhage. So we have to remember that, but hypertensive people and ergometrin. So lessons from neurological complications, epilepsy, a high-risk condition in pregnancy. So a lot of emphasis on trying to get engaged with other services and get better standards of care. More preconception counselling. Women with headaches, and particularly sudden onset severe headaches, should be treated in the same way as non-pregnant patients, and they can get prompt thrombolysis if they need it. And there's a whole group of women who die who've got other medical and surgical conditions. And again, there's this emphasis on getting senior people involved in their care early on and multidisciplinary groups. If there's a surgical issue, you want senior people involved, not the FY2 coming up first and followed by the registrar, followed by the consultant. You need senior people involved. And I think that's much better than it used to be, certainly in our unit. And just a reminder, this is just the women's country of birth and the rates per 100,000 maternities of death within those different groups. So if you're born in the UK, you've got an 8.6 chance per 100,000 maternities of dying. If you're born outside the UK, it's almost double. And talking to, particularly in London, there's some hospitals there have got very, very high proportion of non-UK residents. They have quite a tough time with, you know, interpreters and getting people into care. I mean, there's a lot of issues involved in them, but it's just something that's very good to be aware of. With particularly Sri Lanka and Ghana and Nigeria and Somalia being very, very high-risk communities. It's not teased out as to why that is, we can speculate how it is, but they are. But it's good to be aware of that being an issue. So in summary, there's been a significant fall in maternal mortality, which is great despite the changing demographics. Indirect deaths are more of a problem than direct deaths. Great emphasis on senior clinical multidisciplinary care and complex cases, think sepsis and prevent flu. This is a nice pink one just to finish off with. This is women admitted in the second trimester with vomiting and preterm rupture membranes, chorioamnionitis that had killed her unborn child. But she was picked up promptly. The sepsis 6 bundle was applied to culture. She got antibiotics after discussion with an appropriate person. She got antibiotics within an hour of the diagnosis. However, she started to get unwell. I mean, despite all that, she got poorly. She got hypertensive. So she went on to a hysterotomy to remove the source of the sepsis, which was her dead child. And she went to ITU, and then she made a full and complete recovery. So she got very good care, but she got a bit worse. But then they thought, let's get rid of the source of the sepsis, and she got better. So that's a nice kind of story to end on, because in previous days that might not have been picked up on earlier. Okay, thank you. I'm very happy to answer any questions, though I might refer you back to the report if I can't answer them.
Thank you very much, Liz. Still, thrombosis is the leading direct cause.
Mm-hmm.
In the case report, was there anything which the anesthetist could have improved? Like, we normally prescribe the enoxaparin.
Mm-hmm.
Was there any discrepancy in the dose and the lady weight, or was there any time delay, or is it just the thrombosis was because of the pre-existing heart conditions?
It's not one of the key topics in this report, so that amount of detail wasn't there. So, as I said, the whole amount of data is analysed, but they chose those specific topics, and thrombosis, I think, is the next report. So the one we're writing just now, it will have thrombosis in it, so I don't have that amount of detail in it. But there's constant reference to the fact that we are very much involved in those mothers cared, and therefore we should be involved in ensuring that they get their dose and they get it for long enough. I mean, it's been an incremental thing, hasn't it? But I find it hard to remember that to write when it should stop as well. And, you know, I'm always thinking about the dose and the weight and all the rest of it, but I forget that I have to put in the when it stops as well. So I mean, it's not always done right. I think there's recognition it's not all done. It's not always done optimally. Probably even in their own units. Okay.
I just wanted to ask, I know the maternal death rates come down, but do you think it could be as a result of the fact that the inquiry stopped and there was a big backlog of lots of cases, or do you think their case ascertainment was actually quite good?
That's what they certainly feel, and sort of when you sort of read about it, people seem to have they still were able to punt them into the central system initially, CMAs, and then the NPEU in Oxford received the cases. Just didn't have a mechanism for analysing them. And I say it is better. You know, it's all done online, but you know, very secretly, and you have to do it. It used to be case notes came along long double wrapped, and took them home and read them at home and left them behind. You know, that doesn't happen anymore. Nothing is printed out. You know, it's all online. It's very secure. And my understanding is, and talk to my advisor, I think this is right, that they were able to report the cases to the central body, either CMAs or NPEU. There wasn't a mechanism for assessing them. but there was a huge backlog. So I don't, I guess that could, you never know for sure, but they checked back with the maternal, with death certificates as well, which always underestimate. But there's a feeling, I think, they've got a very good case ascertainment. And that was one of the reasons, I don't know if it was just people's paranoia, but it's a feeling that maybe governments didn't like these kind of reports, because at times it looks like we've got a higher death rate than some the equally well-developed countries, but we actually look at it, whereas other places don't. The States have been one of the, has got some of the worst maternal mortality rates, I think, despite such a wealthy country, but they don't scrutinise them anything like as closely, because I don't think they really want to know. Anything else?
Okay, well, thank you very much, Liz, for a very thorough talk.
Thank you. Thank you.